When you were the first man in to go into a Taliban camp,
yep.
for example, mm-hmm. how did you prepare for that?
Everything is it's a numbers game, you know. When I was stacking up against the door, my initial thought was, when I go through that door, I know there's someone stood on the other side with a weapon. When I go through that door, what are the chances of that person, that untrained person, getting one or two bullets off on his weapon? Okay, the chances are quite high. What are the chances of one of those bullets hitting me in the head and killing me outright? That's very slim. You know, it might hit me in my body armor, it might hit me in the leg. So what are the chances of me actually dying? It's slim, because I'm the aggressor, I'm the trained soldier. By the time I get in and finish the job, all my power's on my back, he will come in and finish the job. So the likelihood of that them getting a kill shot is very, very slim. So
this
the odds are with me.
This is an assessment you make before you move in.
Repetition. I made these assessments after kicking 10, 15 doors down. You just learn to use this emotion. You learn to sort of do these calculations in your head very, very quickly.
But what about fear? Doesn't that disturb in a way?
Fear is always there. Fear is, you know, people who say they can conquer fear are liars. You can't conquer fear. But what you can do, you can harness fear. And you make it work for you. Fear is an emotion that we all have. You know, I could talk to everyone in the crowd here and they would explain fear to me. We'll all have the same explanation of fear. That's how we layer it. You know, we have a horrible tendency to complicate everything that happens, right? Fear, acknowledge the fear for what it is, but then we layer it. We go, right, am I going to die? Am I going to come out of this alive? Am I going to see my family again? That's putting negatives on negatives. The moment, so you strip the emotion, you strip the situation down to what it is. You don't complicate things. And when you can do that, life almost becomes black and white. It's not, but it almost becomes so simple. And that's how I think. I just think in the simplest terms, and I don't complicate things.
But do you think about the fact that you've killed a lot of people that are someone's father?
No.
You are the father of five yourself?
No. No, not at all. Like I said, there's good and there's evil in this world. I'm a good man. I know that. And if you surpass, like I said, if you surpass a certain threshold of evil, then you do not deserve to be walking this planet. And that's how I saw it. I never saw it as, again, it was never personal. I never saw it as this is someone's. You know, you listen. It's one of those, if you live by the sword, then you must expect to die by the sword. You know, it's just, again, taking extreme ownership of yourself, you know, holding yourself accountable, listen.
Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. I have a special guest on with me today, James Glancy. James served in the British military for a number of years, and he does some pretty cool work these days. James, how's it going?
Hey, how are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. So we'll kind of walk through career a little bit, and then we can also talk about what it is that you're up to these days.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can we start with how long you were in the military?
Yeah, so my full-time service was 10 years, but if you add together the time I did before I went regular and then after in the reserves, probably stretches to about 14. But the story began probably at school. I joined the cadets, and I was a pretty hyperactive kid, and it was the cadets that got me focused for school, focused for sport, got me the grades to get through college. And being in the cadets, being outdoors, the discipline of the military, that's what inspired me to apply to join the Royal Marine Commandos. And I got a scholarship age 17 years old to go to university. sponsored by the Royal Marines. That was like 1999. And so that's what set me up, really. That set me up to go to university. But my full-time career in the Royal Marines began in 2004, which was an interesting time because I was at university as a second lieutenant in the Marines when 9/11 happened.
Do you remember exactly where you were that day?
I remember everything in slow motion. We had just been down at Commando Training Center on the southwest coast of the United Kingdom. We were in the early stages of training, and we had been got up early, thrashed around the river estuary in the mud, probably got back and washed ourselves off, and then got into parade uniform. And someone said, oh, there's been some sort of incident in New York, maybe a terrorist attack. No one knew what was happening, but we all piled into the television room, and there it was. And you can imagine, remember the TVs back then weren't these flat screen LCDs, they're sort of those tubular big old things were sort right. of piled into this room. And some of the more senior guys, so I was young, I was 19, but some of the more senior guys who were doing officer training, they'd already been enlisted for years. Corporals, sergeants who were coming to do officer training, they said, you know, we're going to war. Then, so I did the first four weeks of training, and then I went to university. And when I finished in 2004, Iraq had happened and Afghanistan was just kicking off again.
So when you mentioned the cadets before, would that be similar to like the Boy Scouts in America?
No, I did Scouts.
So that's different. I see.
Yeah, no. So I would say cadets in the UK is like militarized Scouts. So we it's like army training. So you have an Air Force section that does flying. You have army cadets, and you go in the field. You shoot guns. You make camps. You learn section attacks, troop right. attacks. You learn tactics and survival, but it's really young. It's leadership and teamwork training in a military environment for young girls and boys.
And is that like what, like teenager age range, or?
I think they take cadets from about 14 to 18.
Okay.
Yeah. It's great. I mean, we don't, as you know, in the USA, we don't have the same types of gun laws. People don't have gun ownership. So, you know, if you are interested in using weapons and you want to learn, the cadets is the way you do that. And it's the way, and that's what gives you those early skills. So it sorted me right out going from Cub Scouts into cadets. And then, you know, it was just a natural progression to go to university as a Royal Marine sponsored officer. And then boom, 2004, I'm afraid it was game on for everyone in the British and United States military, because we ended up with two conflicts on the go.
Early on, after September 11th, I think it was the next month and a half or 2 months or so, the CIA had sent people into Afghanistan, and then other special operations units from over here were there trying to capture Bin Laden in the Tora Bora mountain range. And that was actually the first time I had read about the British Special Boat Service, because we had Delta Force commandos were there, along with some guys from Special Forces, Green Berets. And there was a book written by a former Delta commander about that situation. And in his book, he had mentioned how they had teamed up with the British SBS. And that was the very first time I've ever even heard of that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not going to confirm or deny it, but rumor has it they were there in the early days. And, you know, if they were there, I'm sure they did a good job. And, what's interesting about that era of that phase of the war is sort of the Rumsfeld campaign, that it was about working with foreign national forces and militias like the Northern Alliance, getting rid of the Taliban. It was absolutely not about nation building. A very quick operation, you know, initially very, very successful. It's interesting to see that working with foreign militias was the tactic that we come back to in Syria and in Iraq when fighting against the Islamic State. But in between that, we sort of got into this nation building counterinsurgency work, which, you know, if you to judge now, hasn't been hugely successful.
Right.
So we've kind of come full circle. But those early years, now there's some really quality work coming out in terms of the strategy, the politics, what's going on in Pakistan, ISI, through to actually tactical, what was going on in the mountains, what was going on with the calling in the air from the B-52s. It's all coming to light now, and it's fascinating.
Yeah, it definitely is. So this is something I've always kind of been curious about. You know, you hear the name Royal Marine Commandos. In the U.S., the term commando is usually attached to someone who belongs to some special operations unit. Are the Royal Marine Commandos considered special operations in the UK, or is it more of like a light infantry?
So the Royal Marines are elite forces. The Royal Marines Commando course is the longest basic infantry course in the world, but the Royal Marines are an amphibious force. So they have extra training for mountaineering, for boat work, for operating in extreme climates, such as the Arctic. So the physical nature of the commando course, and when we talk about the commando course, the original commando comes from the South African word commando. There were commando units with a K in the Boer War at the turn of the 20th century, so around 1900. Very effective small teams. The British commandos comes from the Second World War.
Right.
And it's synonymous with the Fairburn Sight commando dagger. And that's the famous fact. I've got one just in the room here with me. But that commando dagger, the commandos were famous for parachuting or being dropped off by boat over the beach or kayaking, canoeing into behind enemy lines and doing small missions, special operations missions. And the Royal Marines still does specialist work, but it also does the generalist infantry work. So you'd have seen the Royal Marines take a profile in Afghanistan very similar to the US Marines or other infantry units. But the Royal Marines has specialist roles. So, for example, they look after the nuclear capability in Britain. They do a small team boarding party work, counter-piracy work, terrorist work at sea. And right now, as we speak, they are working for the force protection and counter-Iranian operations off the off the straits between Iran and Oman, where we've got incidents there.
Right.
They span the role of specialist work, but not tier one special forces work. But it's critical to know that you can join the Royal Marines straight off the street as a civilian, very much like the Navy SEALs. And the physical tests are incredibly demanding. They're probably up there with the most demanding infantry physical training course you can do in the world, which is what earns you your Green Beret. And you get that extra specialist training, which is why they're considered an elite force, but they don't carry out tier one operations.
Right, so like high value targets and that kind of thing that's more for the SBS, SAS and stuff like that.
SAS and SBS, that's right. So high value targets and hostage rescue. But you know, the Royal Marines have extensive capability in reconnaissance and surveillance, setting up beachheads. They're the lead asset in the northern flank of NATO. So protecting that northern flank during the Russians, during the Cold War. And we've now gone back there. The Royal Marines are back up there training hard, training with our Scandinavian counterparts in those cold temperatures, because obviously Russia has rearmed and is more aggressive in posture now. So the Marines are deployed right now all around the world, some working in small teams, you know, four-man teams, others working at a commando strength, which is like your regular infantry battalion. But it's a corps. You have every speciality from drivers to demolition to mortars to heavy weapons to Arctic warfare to drill instructors. Everything is contained. The Royal Marines Corps has everything it needs to sustain itself on operations.
So then it was, you said 2004, right, where you were done with school and you were full-time into the Royal Marines?
That's right, yeah. And my first operational tour was in 2006. We deployed straight to Kabul, and that was the time things started kicking off. That operation for Britain was called Op Herrick 4, and Op Enduring Freedom would have just been getting going properly at that point. And Britain sent parachute regiment, fusiliers, Gurkhas down into Helmand with the view of trying to peacefully get a grip of poppy harvests and dislodge remaining Taliban. But as we know, that kicked off into intense combat.
Right.
So that was my first tour. That was just a short tour, 5 months. We came back from that, had 5 weeks R&R, and then my company, Charlie Company from 40 Commando, we flew out to Gibraltar. And Gibraltar is on the southern tip of Spain. It's a British dependency, so it's part of the United Kingdom. Very small piece of territory. So Royal Marines actually won the Rock off the Spanish in 1805, and they're still really pissed off about that. So there's a lot of political annoyances. But we met up with the Royal Navy in Gibraltar. And tradition has it, we ran up the Rock of Gibraltar in the morning after a big night out on the booze. Then the following morning, HMS Ocean and a flotilla departed down to West Africa, to Sierra Leone, where we were doing jungle training and a show of force during the Sierra Leone elections to make sure that they happened without the return of the West Side Boys, which I think everyone will remember from the movie Blood Diamond.
Right, and so the West Side Boys, were those also the guys, I think it was 2000, there was an operation in Africa, I think it was in Sierra Leone, and I think it was the West Side Boys, where some UN personnel were attacked. I don't remember if they were British citizens who were under the command of the UN at the time, and then the SAS went in for a hostage rescue.
That was British troops actually. And those guys were captured. They had a hard time. And that operation, if you read the books and you speak to people, it's interesting because SBS were there as well. They did the reconnaissance and they were on the river. They went in first up the river and they got the confirmation of the target. And then it was a helicopter assault force with the SAS. There may be an SBS troop on it. Maybe a few guys on it. I don't know the full details. But they went and did successful hostage rescue and took out all the West Side Boys. That's one of those old school famous jungle hostage rescues, which is now notorious and legendary.
Right. So then by the time that you were there, things had calmed down a little bit, or were they still pretty?
Things had calmed down, but they hadn't. Those people hadn't gone. They, like in any insurgency, once they've been hit hard, they were off in the jungles, in remote towns, and it's one of those things. It's like with Iraq or Afghanistan. If we went in and left, the place just returns to normal. So we'd gone in, got rid of them, done some training, put a bit of money into the country. But we had largely pulled out. We left a sort of training mission there. But if we needed to send the Marines and the Navy down there for the elections, because that's the time when they would be confident enough to give it another go to take over the country. So we just did this entire commando plus amphibious operation, deploying from the UK via Gibraltar, where we went over the beach at night, big show of force. Big exercise with, you know, as you do with a fake enemy, lots of noise, planes, helicopters, just showing them, like, don't mess about, guys. We're back. And there's going to be elections, and they're going to be fair and free. And don't think you're going to be chopping anyone's arms off like you did last time, because the Marines are back in town. So we did that, and it worked. And there were free and fair elections. And then that was just, for me, great opportunity. And all the guys from Charlie Company and 40 Commando to get experience in the jungle, you know, away from home again, somewhere that you wouldn't ordinarily get to in primary jungle. So we spent a month training in the jungle. So, you know, year one, that first sort of proper year deployed was Afghanistan followed by Sierra Leone. So brilliant for me as a young second lieutenant, as a troop commander, to learn my trade.
Okay, so then after you returned back to the UK, did you continue as a commando in the Royal Marines, or did you then move on?
No, I spent 6 years in total in the Marines. So I then went up to the Fleet Protection Group, Royal Marines, in Scotland, in Faslane, which is where our submarines are, some of our submarines are, and beautiful part of Scotland where all the locks are. And I did some duties up there, and then I actually ended up deploying to Belize, where we have another some British training camps, which are sort of colonial legacy, and we went out to Belize to do some more jungle training. So I got another month in the trees. But at that point, I realized I was missing the tempo of operations. So I volunteered to join the Royal Marines Armored Support Company, which we have these vehicles called Vikings, which are amphibious. They're designed for over the beach, rapid, first in strike amphibious operations. They're designed to be the, the Marines are there as the first troops into the theater of war. They're not designed for counterinsurgency, but they had been deployed there, and I heard they were really getting amongst the thick of it with the combat in Helmand. So I volunteered to do the Viking course, and I short toured in Scotland, came back from Belize, and went straight back to Afghanistan for 8 months as a troop commander down in Helmand. And that's where the real combat came in between 2007 and 8, because every time you go out on the ground, you get into some sort of minor tick, troops in contact, you know, some sort of firefight. And for the first 4 months, that was fine, because these vehicles are, they've got armored protection. You've got a big general purpose machine gun, which is 7.62 millimeter, very similar to the XD, or you've got 50 cals on there. And, you know, we could more than hold our own, win all our battles. And, you know, it was a really good place to learn. What changed after 4 months was they started to learn a lot of their ID techniques from the Iranians and also from Iraq. Right. They worked out how to make proper shape charges and how to lay, you know, an intense IED or minefield. And from January 2008 to February, every week, my guys, we had a mine strike. Wow. So that's the first experience of losing men, of, you know, things going bad under my command, when suddenly not only are we losing vehicles and men, but then you're stuck and you're in a proper ambush, and then you're fighting for your life. Rather than being the battlefield bully and going out, then suddenly realize, okay, it's all fun and games until someone gets hurt.
Right. And you had mentioned the Gurkhas earlier. Have you ever worked with them?
Yeah, I mean, one of the great things about Afghanistan is that you work with all elements of British Armed Forces, Army, RAF, you know, occasionally some people in the Navy, obviously the Royal Marines, British Royal Marines part of the Navy. But we worked with the other ISAF nations, the International Security Assistance Force. There was 36 nations. So we got experience. Yeah, I was working alongside Gurkha engineers, brilliant guys. But, you know, I worked alongside US Marines, I worked alongside Navy SEALs, mountain divisions, and nations like you probably wouldn't even know the capital nation of, you know, in Eastern Europe. We found some amazing special forces units and Scandinavian units that we got on well with, you know, occasionally share a drink with, and we fought alongside. So, yeah, it was a tough, but an unbelievable time.
Right. And are you familiar with some of the history of the Gurkhas? Like, just like a, maybe we can do like a brief walkover of that.
Am I familiar with the history of the Gurkhas? In some aspects, I am. But I can give you sort of, maybe for your audience, an overview.
Yeah.
And maybe that will lead on to you should potentially interview my friend Nims, who's doing Nims Dye, who was in the SBS Gurkha, first Gurkha to get into Tier 1 Special Forces in the UK. And he's doing a challenge right now, all the world's 8,000 meter peaks in 7 months. And the previous record 7 years.
Oh,
so he's,
yes, I'm familiar with him. I don't know him or anything, but I think I've seen something about that online somewhere. Yeah.
Well, I started with Nims, and he's nailing that. So the Gurkhas, they come from Nepal,
right?
And Britain, as it did during the Empire, found itself campaigning on operations in Nepal, fighting the locals there. I mean, why you'd be in the foothills or in the Himalayas fighting near Everest, don't ask me, but we found out, you know, Brits found themselves from South Africa, you know, over to Afghanistan, obviously America, you name it, there was a fight going on. But the Brits fought the Gurkhas, and there was a huge amount of respect for the way the Nepalese fought. And I believe the history says it correctly, that an agreement came that they would serve under the Queen, or the King at the time would have been the Queen, and serve as part of the British Empire, and form the first Gurkha unit. And the Gurkha units serve with distinction in the Second World War, particularly in the jungles out in Burma, out in that campaign with the 8th Army Field Marshals, Slim's 8th Army. And they've gained this fearsome reputation as a very hardy, competent, aggressive soldier who uses the cookery knife, this big curve-shaped knife. And it is said that if they draw the knife in battle, they have to draw blood. So if they haven't killed an enemy or hacked up an enemy with it, they cut themselves before they resheath the knife.
Wow.
And they've got a fearsome reputation. The Japanese were terrified of them. So, yeah, so, you know, the Gurkhas have a great reputation, and it's a privilege to, you know, work alongside them operationally in Afghanistan. But also, you know, the Marines is well regarded, and one of our competitors is the Parachute Regiment in Britain. And working alongside with them on operations is also a fantastic experience. And I found with the British military, our machine works very well when you get these units that are competitive with each other, when we work together, it's pretty awesome.
I want to take a minute to talk to you about our sponsor for this week's podcast, War Dragons. War Dragons is a real-time strategy video game, and you can play it right on your phone. With over 150 different dragons to breed, each has different attack styles and abilities. The month of July is the month of our independence. War Dragons is partnering with Stack Up, an organization dedicated to bringing military personnel, military veterans, and civilians together through a shared love of video gaming. War Dragons will match all donations made through the link in-game between July 4th through July 31st, up to a maximum of $10,000. Donors will also get an in-game portrait. If you can't donate but you want to support StackUp's work, breeding your dragons in-game can also help contribute an additional $10,000 donation by War Dragons. Download War Dragons. Visit podcast.wardragons.com/recon on your phone or tablet for more details on how to participate. That's podcast.wardragons.com/recon. Right. Yeah. I think it's interesting because over here on the state side of things, during the Iranian embassy siege, Delta Force had planned this operation to rescue hostages at the American embassy. And it failed for several reasons, but one of the reasons there wasn't a good working relationship between the different branches. of the military. So through that failure, the idea of a joint special operations command was floated, and then that became a reality. And then the different units, like special operations units from the different branches, would cross train and work together, and it's produced incredible.
Yeah, absolutely.
Results.
So that you're talking about Operation
Eagle Claw.
You're talking about Operation Eagle Claw. Yeah. So we have our own Iranian embassy siege in 1981, as you know, which has happened in London.
Right.
And that, and you know, the SAS, they were already famous, but that's what threw them to global notoriety when Margaret Thatcher released the British SAS to take down the Iranian embassy in the United Kingdom because they were killing hostages. So the SAS went in and wasted all but one of those terrorists. And that became famous. And what interestingly about that, my father, he's a cameraman, and he was in Afghanistan in the 80s living with the Mujahideen whilst they were fighting the Russians. But he, and previous to that, he filmed the Iranian embassy siege in the UK. Secretly, and that's the famous footage that still goes around.
No way.
Yeah, so he filmed that. The SAS were initially really annoyed about it, but in hindsight, obviously, they are very pleased to have those memories recorded forever.
Right, yeah. I mean, there wasn't much discussion about it until the last couple of years, like as far as the people who were involved on the SAS side. But I think, obviously, people knew about the SAS, but that was the first, like, you know, live action kind of view of what special operations is and hostage rescue is.
Yeah.
And it shocked the world.
Exactly. I mean, essentially operations like that, you know, like the, what was the name of the operation to get bin Laden called? I can't remember its name, but.
Neptune Spear.
Neptune Spear. When you've got something so visual on a high value target where the world's press are there, then success and failure become a huge story. And the special operations are a mixture of cataclysmic failures and heroic successes, snatching success out of the jaws of defeat, or vice versa. And that, you know, you see that in the history of the Royal Marines, and then you see that in the history of the SAS and the SBS, and of course the same with the US Special Operations Forces.
Right. So, kind of talking on the history of the British Special Forces, I think it was on Netflix. There was a series. I probably saw it within the last year. I'm not sure exactly when it was produced, and it kind of talked about the history of the SAS in North Africa during World War II and kind of how they came about and that kind of thing. And it was very, daring, very out of the box kind of thing. And it was very successful. So some people are familiar with some of the history of the SAS. Can we talk about some of the history of the SBS?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I find interesting about modern special forces as opposed to their roots, both units, the SAS and the SBS, is that everything right now is very clinical. We use technological superiority, physical robustness, but you know, we draw on a lot of intelligence and supporting assets in order to achieve effect, in order to be successful on an operation. But the foundations of the SBS and SAS are much more rudimentary, in that it was the daring attitude, intelligence, and just the guts of a group of people who looked at conventional military operations and said, you know, why are we working like this? We're taking a lot of casualties. It's so obvious how we're working to the enemies, and we're not exploiting their vulnerabilities. Why are we not thinking asymmetrically? Why are we not playing dirty? Why are we not surprising them in their beds at night when they're not expecting it? And they got together bits and pieces of equipment. They made a plan, and they got a bit of backing from some senior commanders, senior officers, and said, look, we want to try things differently. We don't want to telegraph our position and go, you know, left flanking or straight up the middle. We want to take these guys out in small teams, parachuted behind enemy lines, and cause chaos. So with the SBS, it's, you know, it's very much like that. If you think of the Second World War, the coastline that the Nazis occupied was massive. You've got the southern flank in the Mediterranean. Then you've got all along the channel along France, all the way up to Norway. And what the SBS was for, its most famous operation with the Cockleshell heroes. That operation was targeting Nazi ships up the Gironde in Bordeaux, and which Gironde's a river. And the idea was to block off the river by sinking a load of their vessels where they sat in port. But you couldn't drop in there, and you obviously didn't have targeted airstrikes back then. So the plan was they selected a hard group of Marines and Army commandos. They did a specialist selection, running around on trying to gauge their intelligence to operate on their own. So could they did basic escape and evasion, then they did basic boat work, advanced weapon work, and the group that got selected were dropped off by submarine. I think it was the HMS Tuna submarine, dropped them off the coast in these old school canvas canoes, two-man canoes, and they kayaked into the river system, into the Gironde. Some of them didn't even make it. The sea was so rough. I think two or three capsized. Guys were killed before they even got in to the main slog. They then paddled up the river by daytime, sleeping in the reeds, like camouflaged out, sleeping in their boats. And when they got there, some of them had some diving gear, and they slipped underwater with limpet mines, put them on, stuck them to the vessels on timers, and then they bugged out. And they successfully blew up a lot of these ships. And those, as they went on their escape of evasion across France, many of them were caught and executed under the Hitler's commando order, which was any special operations forces, any commandos caught behind Nazi lines were to be immediately executed or firstly tortured by the Gestapo and then executed. So most of those guys didn't escape. Some did, but that's one of our most famous raids was the Cockleshell Heroes raid. That sort of set the standard for doing something completely crazy. And, you know, of course, it may not have had a huge strategic effect, but the morale on the British public back home to think, you know, our boys are risking it. They are causing chaos. They really annoyed Hitler when he heard about this operation. That was a sort of modern day foundation of British maritime amphibious special forces.
Right, and then I think even after, for years, there were some issues with funding and things like that, and it kind of took a while for the SBS to be considered like a, you know, top-tier unit and get that kind of funding and support as well.
Well, I mean, the SAS was disbanded after the war.
SBS, they stayed together, or were they disbanded as well?
Yeah, they had small operations teams kept going, but they...
Okay.
After the war, the conventional military commanders, you know, they looked down their noses at special operations. They thought it was ungentlemanly, and they did everything they could to disband special operations unit. Like, and the SOE for this, the special operations executive, responsible for the Heroes of Telemark raid on Hitler's heavy water in Norway, they were disbanded, which I think is tragic. We should recreate them, but a lot of those units were disbanded.
Right.
The SAS and SBS survived, and they have served all around the world on many in many conflicts that we've all heard of. But I guess it wasn't until the Falklands that they kind of emerged in popular military history again, when the SBS and the SAS were the first to deploy into the Falkland Islands when we fought against Argentina. And then, of course, the SAS and SBS were deployed extensively into Iraq in 1991. But we, you know, we don't really have this categorization of tier one, tier two, in the same way as the US does, because our special forces units are generalist special forces. So they conduct surveillance and reconnaissance. They conduct offensive action, so strike, HVT operations, and of course hostage rescue, and they'll train foreign forces very much like the Green Berets. So they do span a number of areas that American special forces span, but the concept is to be globally deployable anywhere in the world, able to withstand any environment, ready to respond to the government's requirements silently and in a deniable fashion.
So can we talk about your journey into British Special Forces?
We can, yeah. And, you know, of course, I will have to publicly caveat that. I can't talk about operations or people, personnel, as you well know. But I read those books back in the 90s about the SAS and SBS during the Gulf War One. So Bravo 2-0 is a very famous book here by a guy called Andy McNabb.
Right.
SAS operation that went wrong behind enemy lines in Iraq when they were fighting Saddam Hussein. And then I read an SBS book, and it was about a similar sort of time to I learned to dive, did my paddy course in Florida, which is where my affinity with wildlife and sharks came in, and we'll come back to Shark Week later on. But I did this dive course, and there's a US Navy SEAL training us as a young kid, and he's obviously been in the Navy SEALs now. He's a paddy instructor. So again, this fascination about naval diving and special operations, and bought all the books, and I set my heart on becoming a special operator at 13, 14, 15 years old. So the Royal Marines for me was something I wanted to do, but my path was always to go towards the SBS. So after my second tour of Afghanistan, I did a few other postings within the Marines, and I applied for selection for the Special Forces. And selection between the SAS and SBS is joint. It's the same selection. And I was successful for the first time round. And that saw me go into the system, which, like the US, they train you in absolutely everything. You get no spare time because you're either training, preparing for operations, or on operations. And that's the cycle. It's brutal. And of course, you know, the time I was in was during the Arab Spring. Afghanistan was, really intense by that point. So I was all around the world on operations doing, you know, a variety of generalist tasks, either in small, very small teams, or doing the door kicking high value target work, which you'd come to expect. But yeah, I mean, an absolutely fascinating time. And, you know, I'll be honest, I didn't do a full long term career. And I wish I'd done more in hindsight. But though the years I served, you know, they've been Britain's war years. Between 2003 and 2012, 2014, we were on tour constantly. Things have changed a lot now. Unless you're in the special operations world, the regular forces is not as much going on. But the 10 years I had the Royal Marines and Special Boat Service were, you know, probably the most enjoyable years of my life, but crazy busy and just all focused on operations.
So you've received the Conspicuous Gallantry Cross. In the UK, that is the second highest award.
Yes, I did. It's funny, I almost crashed my car when my commanding officer rang me up and said he wanted to speak to me, because I was like, I thought, here we go, I'm going to get sacked. And when he told me, I then rang my dad, and he almost walked in front of a bus. It was crazy. I did receive that, and, you know, it is absolutely humbling. But I'd be interested to know the take from a lot of American soldiers that have been given these awards, because every operation I've been on, the risk that we took was equal. You know, especially in asymmetric warfare, where the next step you could take could be on a mine or an IED. you know, these guys are shooting out of windows. You can never see them. They're like ghosts. So the risk is there for everybody. And as a commander, you know, your guys are taking usually greater risks. So I always feel like when they give out an award, whether it's people that won the Victoria Cross, a military cross, a CGC, those people, and like myself, we carry, you definitely carry that for the team, for the troop, for the unit that you are in, because I think it's hard to identify any individual act as being superior or more gallant than what everyone else has done.
Yeah, I think one thing that you'll hear from a lot of people who have received awards of that kind of high level of valor is similar. Like, the sentiments are always similar. You know, because you're out there as a team and you're all fighting to survive and stuff like that. So usually, you know, you hear those same kind of sentiments. I've had a guy on, he was in the Australian SAS, and he received the second highest award for valor, I believe it was. And he was just talking like the operation for which he received it was, you know, something that everybody played a huge part in, and it wasn't just him.
Who is that then?
Brad Watts.
Okay. I know those guys. I work with the Aussies. They're great. They're great fun.
Yeah. And he just kind of explained how, like, everyone involved in that mission was just an integral part to saving this guy's life who was shot by a sniper. And, he was a medic. And it's just kind of the same thing, I guess. Would you be able to talk about that operation, or you can't talk about that?
You know, maybe in 10 years. That's it. The thing is, I'm still friends in contact with guys serving. And it's just the nature of what our special operations guys are doing has become even more secretive, because warfare has changed into this new dynamic, especially the way Russia are behaving. So, you know, if secrecy was important 5-10 years ago, it's critical now.
Right.
Because of the types of work they're doing. And, you know, my association with it, you know, and we're all on social media and stuff like that, and it's just easy to start identifying networks. And that's why I kind of leave the SF stuff at the door. And, you know, in time, you know, like you mentioned, now they're talking about the Iranian embassy siege. You know, 15, 20, 30 years later, that is the time for that stuff. But it's just about, out of respect to the creed, you know, the oath we take, what we do, it is what it is.
Right.
What I do know is it's for operations in Afghanistan. I know you can YouTube it and you'll find it online. Okay. But yeah, you know, we were in operations in Kabul, in the south, in the east, all around Afghanistan, busy times.
Right on.
And by the way, I've never read my citation. They never let me see it.
Oh, wow. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's. I don't know why. I don't think many people in the Special Forces world do see it. But, you know, I just want to, whenever people ask about the Special Forces, you know, I'm very proud of it. I still wish I was serving. I'm always jealous of the guys hearing what they're up to. But the grass is always greener because, you know, they work so hard. And it is dangerous. And even at the time, you don't even realize, like, it's dangerous. Now, you could be on Monday morning practicing parachuting into the sea with your boats or whatever. It just seems like great fun, but there's inherent risk in everything. You know, there are training accidents all the time, whether it's diving, parachuting. What we do is risky. You know, it's weird to think I was part of that world, and I miss it.
Yeah, it's really incredibly risky, and I think that's one thing that people don't take into account, like, outside of the military, is the combat itself obviously is dangerous, but training for combat is very dangerous as well. And I'd read this SBS book years ago. The guy put it out under like a pen name. I can't even remember his
Duncan
name.
Faulkner, first
yep,
interact.
Faulkner, yep, yep.
Yeah, that I mean, that's years old, but that's a very famous book.
And yeah, he was in during a time where they were pioneering several infiltration techniques, and they talked about the techniques of guys getting dropped off by submarine into kind of, you know, wherever they needed to go. And during some of that training, I don't know if it was multiple people, but I know at least one guy was killed during that. So, I think you alluded to this earlier, but basically a lot of the techniques, tactics, procedures were lessons learned from people dying, you know, so it's really serious stuff.
Absolutely. That it is always the way the military, British military, always thinks it's ahead of the game and willing to adopt new tactics and evolve as in an entrepreneurial spirit. But quite often it takes tragedy to invoke change the equipment, change the tactics. But that's the same, I think, in life in general. It does take serious things to happen to go wrong before we start looking at proper lessons that we need to learn that were probably there to be learned before. We just never took them on board until something bad happens, and only then do we implement them and we advance. But you know what's really come to light now? You know, I served an intense 10 years, and what I have noticed amongst my contemporaries from the Marines, Special Forces, and other units around the world is that it's not easy to go to suddenly become a civilian. They train you for combat, but they don't train you to be a civvy. They don't train you for life outside of that intensity or outside the institution of the military. And that, you know, that for me is been a tough transition to where I am now. And yeah, you know, the armed forces, they don't give you much support for that.
Right. And I think, I know this is the case for the U.S. I would imagine that it could be similar in the U.K. But due to the advancements in, you know, medical equipment and procedures and things like that, more guys are surviving wounds from the battlefield than ever before. You know, in previous wars, a lot of these guys would have died. And so that's kind of, it's kind of created like a huge stress on like the healthcare system for combat veterans, wounded combat veterans, and
it's health.
I'm sorry,
and mental health,
and mental health, right, and those mental wounds, right, the ones you don't see, and I think at least over here, people are working through them and trying to figure out how to, you know, a good sort of permanent solution to dealing with some of these things. And a lot of it's been like holistic and, you know, moving away from medication and that kind of thing. And I think just in general in life, you know, health wise, I think that's probably a better option for most people.
Yeah. It is me trying to get into this. I set up a security business, which has become a consultancy, but so many people go on the circuit and they just don't find the same fulfillment. You don't have the same camaraderie. Okay, there's some money involved, but the mission's worthless, and people really struggle. And for me, what's got me, you know, back in good shape physically and mentally is getting involved with our charity, Veterans for Wildlife. So we've got involved with conservation, and we work in Africa training rangers, work in wildlife reserves. Giving the skills towards local communities in places like South Africa, Cameroon, Namibia. We've got loads of requests from other countries to go and train their rangers. And this is a new war, which is the wildlife wars, the illegal wildlife trade network, the trade in rhino horn, ivory, pangolin scales, birds, shark fins, you name it. Animals are a commodity that have been traded for $1 billion industry. And I love the natural world. I love being outdoors. I don't want to see it destroyed. So the skills I've developed have been incredibly useful for work across Africa fighting this war. And that's where I've sort of really found myself again. Okay, I don't have to be in an office. I don't have to be doing some minor security job. There is a mission that I believe in.
And when did you get involved in doing this kind of work? Was it a few years after you got out, or?
It's actually only about 2 years ago. About the same time I actually got asked to be on a TV show, which I didn't want to do. And around that sort of time, I ended up going on a diving trip out to the Galapagos, diving hammerheads and whale sharks. I was like, you know, I need to get back to my roots as a kid. I love wildlife. I love animals. I love diving. This is where it all began, in the water. And I started thinking, how can I get involved with television and preserving species? So I just had some ideas about shark conservation. I started pitching them to TV channels. And I got a break with Discovery Channel last year and did my first show on Shark Week. So we did the Shark Week adventure in the Bahamas. We spent 2 days in the Bahamas floating at sea with Paul De Gelder, who's a host on Shark Week, ex-Australian Navy. And it was at that time, about probably 2.5 years ago, I was pitching doing the shark TV conservation stuff. And then I got approached by the charity was just being set up, Veterans for Wildlife. And it all kind of happened at the same time. I was like, well, this is awesome. I can make TV shows using the skills I developed in the military to educate people about wildlife and make it a fun adventure. And then I can deploy on my own small missions alongside amazing former veterans with different skill sets, and we can train rangers and game reserves. And yeah, I haven't looked back since I got involved with doing Shark Week, Discovery Channel, and now pitching other wildlife shows to BBC. Hopefully we've got some stuff coming up. And then out to Africa to train the rangers, and you're amongst all this amazing wildlife.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I know there's been a large group of Western combat veterans who have gone over to Africa and have done that kind of work, the anti-poaching stuff and training rangers and stuff like that. And it's really fascinating, and I think it's really necessary. You know, it's really horrible if anyone does any research into some of that, what goes on with the animals out there. I know things like rhino horns and stuff like that are sought after.
Well, look, this is a crisis. There's less than 30,000 rhinos left. There were, you know what, there would have been millions, you know, 100 years ago, with less than 30,000. Some of those populations are going extinct. Same with sharks. We've taken out over 90% of the oceanic white tip. And in the Gulf of Mexico, there's been a 99% decline since the 60s. We can't go on like this. And because the wildlife has a value, you know, rhino horn is worth more pound for pound than gold or cocaine. Wow. And so it's a war out there. The military, law enforcement, those skill sets are needed to combat the global illegal trade in wildlife. So we need help. And we're set up in America. So we want to get American vets on board. You know, so to any of the people listening, we need help, whether it's sponsorship and financial resources. We need equipment. I know you guys produce amazing equipment in America. We need equipment, resources, and you know, your veterans. We've got to get involved now, because we want future generations to enjoy the environment, to enjoy wildlife. And there isn't much of it left. So the time is now to get on board with this mission.
So if anybody wants to kind of check you guys out and potentially get involved, where can they go to do that?
Two places, really. Our website is www.veterans4wildlife.org. I'm also one of the director of special projects. So you can find me on my Instagram, at JA Glancy, or Twitter. Get in touch, send me an email. We're looking for people, looking for support. We've got a new project coming up in Belize, so closer to home for the US. Jaguar conservation, hardwood composite conservation, training rangers, you know, you name it. Anything that can be traded, every animal, every piece of you know, tree or wood, they're trading it, and so there is opportunities.
So the trade itself, is that like bigger in like Asia and Southeast Asia, like where it's being bought, like purchased and stuff like that?
Demand, yeah. So it depends what we're talking about. Hardwoods, the cutting down the rainforest for hardwoods in Africa and South America. They're going to the Southeast, but there's demand in the West. We all like nice wood products.
Right.
So the illegal wood timbers end up in our furniture. With animals, yet rhino horn goes into Chinese medicines. It has no – rhino horn's made out of keratin, the same as your fingernails as hairs and hair. It has no medicine properties whatsoever, but they believe in ancient Chinese culture it does. Things like ivory is – elephant ivory is used as sculptures. And then they're using like tiger bones, tiger penises, lion's parts. They grind them up and put them into potions, thinking they're going to give them virility and all sorts of things. It's all nonsense. But there's a lot of money in Indochina, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia. They've become much more wealthy, and there's demand for these animals. The demand is outstripping the number of animals available to provide, and that's why we've got a serious crisis on our hands.
Yeah, it's terrible. I've been familiar with some of these groups. Like I personally know American special ops vets who go out to Africa and do that kind of work, like the anti-poaching stuff and things like that. And I actually think for guys who are getting out, guys and gals getting out, you know, you get off that train that's going 100 miles per hour, and you kind of find that other work isn't quite satisfying. I think just like you found, I think people would find that kind of work really kind of gets you.
It does, and you can volunteer for short tours, like 2 weeks. Most of our people are still working, they have regular jobs, but what it gives them is the ability to connect with veterans, to talk things through, because you can't really talk to other civvies about your operational time. But then you're back out on the front line, you're training rangers. If it's got that operational feel about it, you know, you're living out of a hammock or on the floor. You're sat around the campfire in the evening. It's therapeutic, and it's a good mission.
Yeah, absolutely. And I encourage anybody listening or people who are on their way out of the military on the American side to take a look at it and see if that's something you might have some interest in. And I think it would be very rewarding. So James, I want to thank you for coming on here. You know, it was a pleasure to talk to you, and I've had guests on from the UK, from Australia, and some of our allied nations, but it's mainly Americans who come on here.
Yeah.
So it's always great to get a different perspective and, hear about, what you guys are up to over in the UK. It's really incredible.
Well, thanks very much for having me on. And I'll just say, you guys have got Shark Week coming up on the 28th of July. And I've got a show out on the 30th of July called Shark Wrecked, Crash Landing. And we, Paul DeGelder and I, skydive into the Pacific Ocean.
Oh, that's awesome.
Bit of a survival exercise with sharks, showing that sharks aren't the issue. The water is the problem. So if anyone's interested in Shark Week and a bit of survival, that's what we've got coming up next. And also, please check out Veterans for Wildlife. Get in touch, and I look forward to hearing from you.
And the show, that's on Discovery, right?
Yeah, that goes out, Discovery in the US and Shark Week on the 30th of July at 8 p.m., Shark Wrecked.
Awesome.
The son of a decorated SAS veteran is one of two soldiers killed in a bomb attack in Afghanistan. They were on a routine foot patrol when they were caught up in an explosion on Thursday near Sangin in northern Helmand province. Sergeant Paul McAleese was with the 2nd Battalion, the Rifles. The 29-year-old from Hereford was described as one of the best of his generation and became a father just a week before being deployed to Afghanistan following the birth of his son, Charlie. He is the son of John McAleese, who led the raid that ended the siege on the Iranian embassy in London in 1980. He was among special forces who blew out the building's windows before rescuing 19 hostages from gunmen. The other casualty from Thursday's blast was Private Jonathan Young, who was with the 3rd Battalion, the Yorkshire Regiment. He was 18 and from Hull. He arrived in Afghanistan less than 3 weeks ago, among the reinforcements shoring up units that had taken heavy casualties recently. Their deaths bring the total of British lives lost in the Afghanistan conflict to 206.